Hey, it's Jed Hearn, host of Wizards, Warriors, and Words. If you're enjoying the writing advice on this show, you might like my new podcast, The Jed Hearn Show, where every week I share the best fantasy writing advice that I've learned from publishing 3 fantasy novels and a best-selling video game. There's over 12 episodes that you can listen to right away, including my top 10 fantasy books of all time, how to make fantasy names that don't suck, 2 rules that make writing effortless, and my complete summaries of Brandon Sanderson's and Neil Gaiman's writing classes, and much more. Check it out by searching for The Jed Hearn Show in your podcast app.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Wizards, Warriors and Words, a fantasy writing advice podcast. I'm Jed Hearn, author of Siege of Trebolin, and I'm joined by my only other co-host for today, Rob J. Hayes.
Hello. I'm Rob J. Hayes, author of the War Eternal series. And I'll just throw some books around. Books.
Okay, that just froze for me weirdly, but I think it should have recorded and uploaded it fine. So we'll see what that sounds like.
Froze to me as well.
But that is bizarre. All right, it's off to a rough start. But today we're going to be talking about Rob's latest release, Sins of the Mother, the 4th book in the War Eternal series, which is one of my favorite fantasy trilogies I've read in recent years. Rob's holding it up now. It's a very lovely looking cover by friend of the show, Felix Ortiz. And I really enjoyed the original trilogy, which Rob wrote a few years ago. So I'm excited to get into this book and to chat about it today. Rob, for people who aren't familiar with maybe the original War Eternal series or just the whole series as a whole, how would you sort of describe that thing in a nutshell?
I tend to describe it as a sort of a dark twist on the coming of age fantasy, basically, because it's all about a young girl called, she starts as a young girl, I guess, in book one, called the Skara Helsine, and her rise to the title of Corpse Queen, which is obviously very metal. And look, in this one, she's even sitting on the corpse throne, which is a throne of corpses.
Nice.
It's so metal. So yeah, it's kind of a dark twist to that sort of coming of age. I kind of like to think of it as the anti Name of the Wind, because in Name of the Wind you have Koth, who he's just constantly bigging himself up and saying, "Oh, I did all these absolutely amazing things. I'm the best." And then in the War Eternal you have Esker going, "I'm a horrible person. I did this shitty thing," and she doesn't really lie quite so much.
That is a pretty accurate description. Yeah, kind of similar to Name of the Wind. It's first person, so you really get inside her head. Her head is sometimes not the most pleasant place to be. So that
creates, it's kind of written from, narrated from the future. It's an older Esker looking back on her life, starting in along the Razor's Edge, where she's in prison. She's in the pit, which is an absolutely horrible prison to be trapped in.
Yes. An underground mining cavern, essentially. And it's every bit as horrific as it sounds. So basically, just to give a bit of the backstory of this, you wrote the first 3 books over the course of, was it a year and a half or so? And then you rapid released them, like one book a month. Was that correct?
Yeah, I wrote Let's see. Along the Razor's Edge was 2016, the end of 2016. Lessons Never Learned was 2017, and then 2017 again because it sucked and I had to rewrite it. And From Cold Ashes Risen was 2018. And then, yeah, I released all three in 2020. There was basically 2 months between them. First one was March, second one April, third one May. In a rapid release schedule, and then I figured, you know what, I should probably get to writing the fourth one at some point. So I did. And I'm currently writing the fifth one, the fifth and final one.
Oh, nice. Fifth and final. It's a strange structure to me, like, and I'm curious to hear you talk about that. The fact that it's like trilogy first and then two other books that are coming on at the end of that. What made you decide to split it up in that way?
So I always intended them to actually be a trilogy and a duology, basically, because it's okay. Kind of two different times. They follow a very strict timeline, and the first three books are sort of set over the course of, I think it's something like 3 or 4 years, and then there's a big time skip, and then the fourth book takes place 20 years after the events of book three. So originally I thought, like, I'll have them as a trilogy and then a duology. But the problem is, like, it doesn't really make sense reading the fourth book unless you've read, like, the other three, to be honest, because they do follow on directly from those events. So I just thought, well, rather than having it as a separate trilogy and a duology, I'll have them as book four and book five. But they are kind of like a new chapter in Eska's life, almost. And dealing very much with her children.
It's an interesting way of structuring it.
Well, I mean, it is and it kind of isn't. In many ways, if you look at someone like Joe Abercrombie, who writes a lot of books in the same world, you know, he has his first trilogy, and then he's got a trilogy of standalones, and then he's got another trilogy. So it's kind of the same thing, except I just decided not to split them up. I just decided to keep them all under one series banner.
Did you find it kind of like refreshing to take a break from the series, go away and write some other stuff and then come back afterwards?
Oh, absolutely.
Because I know, like, you definitely had a lot of frustration with writing the series the first time around. So
it's
was that
part
of the reason for the skip as well?
Yeah, this series has absolutely kicked my ass. So I kind of needed it. It's weird. Like, I needed to take a break from the world and from writing in Eska's head. Especially after the first sort of trilogy, because it's very intense writing in that deep first person perspective where you're literally putting yourself in the mindset of that character.
Yes,
it's a very intense way to be, especially with someone as scarred and broken and anxious and depressed as Eska often is. So yeah, I definitely needed a break, and I think from the end of From Cold Ashes Risen, I have written four other books before I got back to it. So
wow,
yeah, getting back into five books, four or five. Anyway, getting back into the mindset of Eska after that sort of a break was quite difficult, to be honest, but I think I got there in the end. Ooh, have I frozen?
One of us froze. I'm not sure whose it is. This is weird. It keeps freezing. So I might have to do some weird editing.
It's because we're on literal opposite sides of the world right now. Technology.
Yeah, the Wi-Fi signal has to go all the way through the center of the Earth.
Yeah.
Past.
And as we know, there are dinosaurs and shit in the center of the Earth.
That's right. And they gobble up those radio signals like you wouldn't believe.
It's true.
Has a lot of protein, apparently. Sorry, what were you just saying in that period where it paused? This is weird because, like, listeners might actually have heard it with no interruption because it's recording separate tracks for us. But for us recording it, I just missed out, like, the last 20 seconds of what you were saying.
Okay. Well, I was just saying, between book three and book four, I wrote four or five other books. It was a good break to have, but getting back into the mindset and the voice of Eska was quite difficult for book four. It took a bit of time, I think I was about 30% of the way through the book before I actually went, yeah, okay, I think I'm back in Eska's voice again now. So at that point, I had to go back and do a bit of editing.
How did you manage to get back in? Did you reread the original books? Did you listen to the audiobooks? What was the process for like reacclimatizing to that world and her voice?
I hate rereading my old books. I absolutely hate it. I don't know why. So I listened to some of the audiobooks. I listened to choice chapters that I thought, yeah, that's quite good. And then, funnily enough, I also listened to Skullsworn by Brian Staveley, which was one of the...
Yes.
One of the books that
the big inspiration.
inspired the whole sort of trilogy, the way that I wanted to write it. It inspired me to do the sort of like the first person perspective. So I listened to that again, and then I thought, okay, I think maybe I'm ready to start trying to get back into it. And then, I mean, yeah, it as I say, it took a while. It took about 30% before I felt like I was fully into it again. But just falling back into the voice was quite fun, to be honest. Getting back into it, but it was also quite changed because, I mean, Fioresca, 20 years has passed.
She's older now.
Exactly. In fact, she's quite a bit older because slight spoilers to events. Time doesn't work right for Eska. She ages a bit faster than she's meant to.
Oh, so, true.
Yeah.
True.
At the beginning of Sins of the Mother, she's actually about 70 years old, at least in body, even though she's only about 40 years old in actual time spent. It's all a bit
weird. Lived a hard life, Eska has.
She's
lived a hard life.
But
You say, because one of the things I loved about the original trilogy was how kind of intricate the magic system was, the idea of sorcery where you swallow these different stones or crystals and it essentially gives you these very specific powers, but also at great cost, like, for example, the one that makes Eska kind of age quite rapidly. Did you find that like limiting or constraining coming back into this as book four? Because I'm not sure to what extent, like, did you plan out, you know, oh, I'm going to write 5 books in this, so I need the magic to be operating in this certain way. Or did you sort of just be like, this is a cool aspect of the magic that I want to do. And then later down the track, you kind of had to contend with how it all fit together, the kind of different puzzle pieces of it. How did sort of work for you?
There's definitely a sort of like, yeah, trying to figure out how it all fits together and working within the system that I've already created. But I purposefully didn't give all the rules to the system out in like the first 3 books. There are other things happening that you only really get into when it comes to the 4th book. Certain things that are mentioned in the first 3 books but only as passing, like Eska has an innate necromancy, which doesn't, you know, she doesn't need to swallow a source for it to be there. That's explored a lot more deeply in books 4 and the upcoming book 5. So there's definitely more to the magic system that I haven't revealed in the first 3 books that's I do start to. And I there are other things that I put in the world which allow me to expand upon it. Things like the Great Eye above the Plaisian Desert, which is this giant eldritch eye staring through from another world. Stuff like that. It allows me to expand and play around with the rules and change them a little bit here and there.
Yeah, I think that was one of my kind of big revelations I had from when we were talking about your writing of this series 2 years ago on a different podcast. And you were talking about how, correct me if I'm wrong here, because I might be misremembering, but you were talking about how there were a lot of different things where you just kind of wrote it as a almost throwaway detail because it sounded really cool. And then later on in the series, you were like, oh yeah, I can actually like use that and I can incorporate that as a big part of this book. So that's something that I felt myself doing it today when I was writing a scene. I was like, I am putting a lot of scenes in, a lot of things in here that are just could be totally cool, random throwaway pieces of information about the world, or could quite easily be spun out into major conflicts in future installments in this series. Was there anything like that for book 4 that you kind of were like, huh, past Rob was a genius and I'm going to steal this cool idea he had and expand upon it?
Yes, all the time. So
can you tell
what
it is, or is it a spoiler?
I will try not to spoil. So there are things I can't talk about because, but yeah, the way I work, especially in book one of any series, as I am a massive pantser, so I just add things that pop into my mind and sound cool. And then it's not until sort of book two onwards where then I have to actually start planning it, and suddenly I'm like, oh shit, I should probably make this actually matter somehow, or draw this and this. And sometimes there's that inspirational moment where it all just clicks and I'm like, wow, I created this back in book one, and now in book three it's relevant and it suddenly makes sense. And there's other times where there are other times where I'm like, okay, I mentioned this a while back and I should really try and draw it in and make it matter somehow, and I don't know how. It's trying to fit the fucking puzzle piece and hammering it in. So there's definitely a lot of that, but in book four, there's obviously the way that the story is structured, Esker drops a lot of hints about the future throughout the books. There's loads of little things, like even in book one, she mentions that her youngest daughter Cyrilef is also known as the monster. It's stuff like that where I come to book four and I'm like, okay, I have to try and make this all work. And there were a lot of little hints dropped. Perhaps too many.
I don't know. That you made in those early books.
Yeah, I know. I think I'm pulling them all together. I definitely seems to be, but yeah, it's really hard to talk about some of the things in Sins of the Mother without massive spoilers.
Yeah, that's fair.
But it all ties back into this sort of like this magic system where, I mean, there's going to be spoilers for books one to three if I'm talking about book four, there just is. But it all ties back into this magic system where the gods, the Rand and the Djinn, are linked together, and you know, they were trapped in the moons and all sorts. It's all just this big sort of mess which I've somehow managed to weave. I come to book four and book five and I'm trying to untangle it all, so it all just makes perfect sense.
Well, the interesting thing I find is that I'm very curious to see how you continued the story on, because I think you could pretty comfortably, obviously you don't want people thinking this because then they won't read book four, but like, you can finish reading book three and that's a satisfying complete ending to the kind of story. And that was certainly my experience. So when I got to that and I found that you mentioned at the end of it, oh, like there's another book coming, I was a bit like, huh, okay. I had a satisfying experience with this. I will still continue reading it. I feel like I've ended it in some fashion. And yeah, I'm always just curious as to stories that kind of do that. Like, I think particularly in recent years when people are complaining about the dearth of superhero movies, one of the big complaints is that you never really trust the endings that they provide. And, you know, you watch something like Endgame or whatever, and it's a very satisfying finale to that whole kind of series and to a lot of characters' arcs. And then the universe sort of keeps going on. And I think they managed it well in that instance. But yeah, I'm always curious as to how people manage to achieve that, manage to like give you these satisfying endings along the journey and then kick you off onto new stories that don't feel like you're treading the same ground or just repeating the same things over and over again. So yeah, was there any concern of that in your mind when you were approaching it, or how did you kind of think about that?
I don't know. I think there's going to be an element of it, and there are going to be people who feel that, yeah, okay, the first three books are a very satisfying conclusion and they probably won't come back. Even though, you know, the story's still going on. And I think that the way you can achieve that is basically by giving the character or characters a solid emotional conclusion. If people feel that the characters have come to an emotional conclusion, even if there's still other stuff going on in the world that might still happen, they'll feel satisfied. because I mean that's one of the sort of major things, especially if you're writing sort of I think first person perspective, that they want to feel that sort of emotional gratification, I guess. And From Cold Ashes Risen did kind of do that. Basically, the bad guy in the conflict that had been set up throughout the first, you know, two books and well, the first three books, that was dealt with. And, you know, Eska was in a slightly happier place. And she'd dealt with some of her inner demons. Sorry, that's one of those little nice jokes
well
that
played,
people
sir.
Who
well played. Well played.
Read it will understand. So she dealt with
I
a lot of
that reference.
Yeah. She dealt with a lot of that. So I think that's probably why it felt like a satisfying conclusion. And then with book four, sort of the problem is how do you then reestablish some of those sort of like conflicts and the like without just repeating some of the a lot of the sort of the elements from the first three books. And there's always going to be some repeating, especially when dealing with emotional consequences, because you know emotional scars don't just leave people. It doesn't matter if you've sort of resolved them, they can still come back and fuck you all over again. So yeah, it's a tough line to walk, and I don't know, but the reception seems to be quite good so far, so I think I've managed to walk it. We'll see.
Nice. We can cut this bit out if you don't want to discuss about it, but how have you thought in terms of marketing the launch, and then how has that sort of gone? You don't have to give private details if you don't want to, but yeah, just in as much detail as possible, how have you structured the launch? Have you been running ads for it? What have you been doing to build up hype and promotion around it and that sort of thing? Just very
I'm happy to talk. So I mean,
sort of strategy has been
one of the sort of biggest things that I did around the launch is obviously I got some new artwork done by Felix Ortiz for the hardback editions of the first three books. So that was sort of a big in many ways promotional push. It's like, hey, look, fancy new artwork, it's gorgeous. Mm-hmm.
This thing is coming back again. Yes,
exactly. So I also changed the ebook covers around to the new versions as well. And I mean, I do have Amazon and Facebook ads running for the series as well. It's mostly trying to push book one again. I'm never really sure how to do how to launch sort of later books in a series. You know, sort of years after the releases, it's kind of weird. The biggest thing you want to be doing is reaching the audience that you already have for books one to three in many ways, because you want, you know, if you've sold, I don't know, pie in the sky numbers, who knows, 1,000 copies, you want to be able to reach those, you know, 1,000 people who have read the first few books and go, hey, here's book four. And that's one of the toughest things, because how do you do that unless they have signed up to your newsletter or are following you on social media? As a self-published author, it's actually very difficult to get hold of those existing readers and say, hey, there's another book. So what you have to kind of hope in many ways is that if they're not signed up to your social media or newsletters, that Amazon's going to do some of the heavy lifting on your part and say, you know, to readers, you bought these three books, here's a fourth. Apart from that, it's sort of like just trying to get onto people's radars, and hopefully with the launch of book four, it will help push book one as well. And that's where most of the ads are focused, because I think with ads you're mostly focused on garnering new readers rather than drawing readers back in.
Yes. Have you lowered the price for that first book to try to get readers in easier?
No, I already have it set at the lowest price point I can on Amazon. So Amazon has two different levels of royalties. You can either select the 30% royalty level or the 70% royalty level. If you select the 30% royalty level, you can go as low as 99 cents and 99 pence. You can offer your book dirt cheap, or if you select the 70% royalty level, the lowest you can set your book is at $2.99 or £2.99. And as I don't want Amazon taking 70% of my profits for no reason, I have it set at the 70% level. So the lowest I can offer my book is at $2.99. And that's a bit of a draw itself. You price book one a bit cheaper than you do the other books in the hope that people will be like, oh, well, it's only this much. I'll give it a try. And then hopefully you'll hook them in book one and they'll move on to book two and book three and, you know, be willing to spend that little bit extra.
This is another bit we can cut out, but do you know what your read-through figures are like for the subsequent books in the series?
Not exactly. I think they're between 40 and 50% from book one to book two, which isn't bad, I think.
Who knows with these things? I've never written a series, so I have nothing to compare it to.
I don't think that's too bad, but it fluctuates on any given day as well. And it also fluctuates from the different formats because my books are also in Kindle Unlimited. There's the two different formats of, there is the paid book sales and there is the Kindle Unlimited page reads book sales. And they have different read through or sell through rates, basically. But yeah, I think from book...
Is the Kindle Unlimited easier to sell through?
I don't know, to be honest. I would imagine it is because people who are signed up to Kindle Unlimited...
Less friction for people to buy.
Yeah, it doesn't technically cost them anything. They're already paying that subscription fee. So it doesn't cost them anything to move on from book one to book two. Whereas if you're not on Kindle Unlimited and you buy book one, you then have to buy book two, which is, you know, an extra price point. So I would imagine it should be slightly higher, but I don't know for sure. But I think from like book two onwards, I think I'm at sort of 80 to 90% read-through rate, which is very good. But then I think if people have moved on to book two, they're pretty much committed to reading the series by that point. Even if they read it just to hate it. I have a few people...
Stockholm Syndrome themselves.
Yeah, well, I've had a few people who have read book one, given it one star, and then gone on to read book two, given it one star, gone on to read book three, given it one star... And they've just hated it the entire way through.
Yeah,
and I'm like,
bizarre.
Why would you do that to yourself? If you hate the book, don't move on. Just drop it.
Yeah. That is bizarre when people do that.
Yeah. I don't get it myself.
I mean, I can understand that with...
I wonder if there's
a completionist
aspect.
I was just
going to
say, I can understand it with like these really... Yeah, I think that's it, right? Because like, I know people who slog through really like dense... kind of, you know, the staples of the fantasy genre series that they maybe don't enjoy, but everyone tells them they have to read or whatever. Like, a lot of people slog through that, even if they're not enjoying it. So, yeah.
You're talking about Wheel of Time right now, aren't you, sir?
Sort of manifested, yeah. Yes, I am. Which I read the first book of it, and, oh man, like, it was a slog. It was a slog. I understand why some people like it. Yeah, not hating on it. Just for me, it was... not a fun 6 weeks of reading when I had so many other things waiting on my plate that I knew I would enjoy reading and hadn't gotten onto, like Joe Abercrombie's new trilogy, which I've just started reading and is phenomenal. And I'm like, why was I slogging through Wheel of Time when I could have read this instead?
Have that new trilogy.
Rant over.
On my
this isn't about Wheel of Time.
I haven't read it yet. But I have just finished listening to
like,
Eye of the World.
I've been sleeping on it for years. Oh, really? What do you think?
Yeah. It's all right. I can see why it is so influential to so many books and authors who have come after, basically. You know, if I feel like it, I'll probably continue with it at some point. Check out the later books, but fuck, I hated Rand. He was such an annoying prick. he wasn't even compelling. He was just annoying.
Yeah. I can't even remember it that well, to be honest. It was like halfway through last year I read it. Yeah, I mean, I think it probably does suffer from like the same thing that Lord of the Rings to me had as well, where like if it had been one of the first fantasy books I read, I probably would have loved it. But the problem is that everything that's come afterwards has been massively influenced by this thing, which means that when I get back to the original source material, the source material now feels like it's copying all these other things, but is less innovative and less kind of interesting, which is like, it sucks, right? And like that is, yeah, I can understand why some people would be annoyed at that criticism of it, but that's just what my experience is. And yeah, it's the same as like, if people try to watch the original Star Wars trilogy today, which I've had friends do, and they're like, yeah, it just feels like I'd seen it all before and it's so cliche. And you just want to like, yeah, tell them, no, this was so innovative and this was so unique, but it like no longer is when you're approaching it with the lens of having seen all this stuff that's come after it. So, yeah. But
there's also,
yeah, we won't rant too much about Wheel of Time.
Well, there's also the fact that you are looking at it through a more modern lens, and it's not just the fact that everything that's come after it has been influenced by it. Well, not everything, but so much has come after it has been influenced by it, and you'll see those influences. But it's also the fact that things were written differently. There were sort of like not just different values, but different ways of writing back then. And I can see that a lot in Eye of the World. There are things like so many of the sort of like the conflicts, the tension were there simply because one character didn't talk to another, or, you know, for no reason, seemingly absolutely no reason, the character just refused to talk to this other character about something quite important, and that created a sort of conflict. So there's stuff like that, which you still see these days, but you don't quite see so much these days because people have kind of got sick of it. they want different ways of sort of conflict. And then there's a few other things, like the bad guys at the end just appearing out of nowhere for no reason. I don't think you get that as much these days. But I think back then it was a bit more acceptable. But fantasy has sort of changed quite a bit. And that's why a lot of the sort of like classical tellings of fantasy have a more modern feel to them. If you look at something like The Ember Blade by Chris Wooding, it's a very classical style fantasy, but it has
love that book so
I do too. But it has a very modern feel to it. It feels like a blending of this classic and modern styles, and I absolutely love
it's
that.
Perfect.
Yeah. But I would imagine it's a book that is influenced by things like Wheel of Time as well.
Hugely.
So, which was in turn...
I mean, there's a Moira scene in it, basically, like in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it's brilliant.
Yeah. I think it's amazing. Ember Blade is a book that lives, like, ridiculously rent-free in my head because, like, just the other day, it just appeared in my brain. And I was like, I haven't read you for 3 years. What are you doing here? Why am I thinking about you? I don't have you on my bookshelf. I rented you from the library. And yet you are appearing here again just to remind me of how amazing this was. And yeah,
because man, we got to get Chris Wooding on the coming podcast.
I would love
point.
To have him on. Yes. Well, that's the other thing, right? It's been so long between books for, I mean, it'll probably be worth it, but yeah, it just felt like that book because I'd never really heard about it from anyone else. I saw it in the library, had a kind of cool cover, picked it up, and then just devoured the whole thing.
It's a very classical fantasy cover like, as well, actually. Hang on a sec.
Maybe the best classical, yeah, kind of fantasy thing I've read. Yeah, so, get the cover up. Sorry.
Because I have the lovely hardcover edition.
But if you Google the cover for Ember Blade... Oh, lovely. Lovely.
It's really...
Rob, maybe just describe the cover for people listening.
Okay. Well, it's a classical style. There are so many different styles of cover, but this is a very classical style, which basically has small characters in the foreground and then big landscape and something in the background, like a, you know, in this case it's a castle with, you know, fires and around it and sort of like birds and all sorts. So it's one of those, yeah, very very classical styles of cover for epic fantasy, and it hits all the right notes for it, basically. God, I've done so much research into covers recently. So, but yeah, no, the, it's one of those that it does quite well at being a very classical fantasy, but with a modern twist. And I think that we're seeing quite a lot of that these days, more in the indie sphere than the trad sphere, I think, actually. I think recently a bit of an indie darling, Ryan Cahill, has released or is releasing a series which has it's a very classical style of fantasy with a modern twist to it again, or with a modern style to it. And he's doing very well with it. And I think that's why, because he's sort of tapped into this audience of people who do want this classical style of fantasy, but they don't maybe like the way that it used to be done with things like Eye of the World or Wheel of Time and everything.
Yeah, they want it a bit faster paced. Probably want more interesting conflicts that they haven't seen before, but they want the kind of set dressing to be similar because that is what is so appealing about the genre. Yeah. I would probably say I should probably reread Ember Blade, actually, because that's sort of what I'm aiming for with my current book, is that sense of like a lot of the kind of tropey, like classical fantasy elements, like dragons and magic schools and that sort of thing. But like a story that is more closer to something like The Departed than it is to Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
But in that sort of, you know, kind of classical setting.
Well, to be honest, it's worth rereading anyway, because it's a fantastic book.
Yeah, that's probably where I've come to be honest.
Also, because book two is coming soon.
For research purposes.
Yeah. No, funnily enough, this was one of the books that helped inspire me when I was planning to write my epic fantasy, which I'm going to be releasing next year. Herald, book one, Age of the God Eater.
Nice.
That was one of those books that I was sort of reading it. And along with... The Faithful and the Fallen by John Gwynn, who was also a guest.
Haven't read it yet.
Previous guest of our podcast,
and a previous episode of this podcast.
Yes, and I was also listening to Stormlight Archive
because we mentioned him before.
It really was, yeah.
Nice.
Because they're, you know, when I'm planning to write something like that, I do tend to sort of like think, okay. Let's read or listen to books that are in the sort of similar genre and style that I'm shooting for. So with writing, you know, Esker, I was like, yeah, Skull Swarm by Brian Staveley, Prince of Thorns by Mark Lawrence, those sorts of books. And then if, you know, when writing, wanting to write an epic fantasy, I was like, okay, let's read some epic fantasies. And I find that's quite useful to get your brain in the mindset of writing that sort of style, basically. I should probably read more progression fantasy, considering I've been writing a progression fantasy recently.
Not a bad idea. Makes a lot of sense. Cool. So we should probably wrap this up here. Before we finish, just to tie it back to Sins of the Mother, which we got very tangented from, but I enjoyed the discussion. It's the name of the show anyway. What was your favourite thing about returning to Esker's world and to that character?
Favourite thing? I don't know. Maybe it was including a character in Sins of the Mother called Jed.
Hey! Oh yeah, I remember Miho telling me about this. I can't wait to see who I am. Do I die a horrible death?
Of course you do.
Nice.
I like putting my friends in my books, but they will always die.
That's
probably
it.
Says more about me than it does anybody else.
Strangled to death by his podcast recording microphone.
Yeah. I think my favourite thing about returning to the world was being in Esker's sort of like head and her voice again. While it was quite difficult and it's very challenging at times, she's incredibly fun to write as at times as well. Because she makes no apologies about the fact that she's a bit of a bitch and she takes no shit. So.
Very blunt, very brash. And that's fun because most people aren't like that in real life. So it's very satisfying.
Yeah, I think it's chapter two where she kicks a guy in the shins just because he clears his throat at her and she doesn't like it. So she's an old lady at this point.
Were you writing that in like a cafe that day and someone was coughing behind you?
I can't write in cafes. I kind of wish I could, but there's too much noise.
Really?
I need silence to write. I can't do it when there's like noise everywhere. Funnily enough, these are my noise cancelling headphones.
Do you listen to music?
No, well, I occasionally listen to instrumental scores when I'm writing action scenes.
Me too.
Something like, I tend to listen to things like Hans Zimmer. There's that classic piece from the beginning of Gladiator, that when there's, the Romans and the Germanic so barbarians good. Facing off, that instrumental score is just gorgeous. But most of the time I reserve music for the dreaming phase, basically, when I'm sort of like trying to come up with ideas or when I'm trying to pull together plot threads or whatever. Because I'll do things like I'll go for a walk, or more often than not, just pace up and down my house with my headphones on, listening to music, and it kind of occupies the body and lets the brain go into that state of, okay, just working in the background and trying to figure things out. Which I find quite useful for the dreaming aspect of things, I guess, for the plotting aspect. And occasionally, some things happen, like I'll hear a lyric and something will just like explode in my mind and it will just take root. It's a fun story, but as I say, next year I'm releasing Herald, Book One, Age of the God Eater. And the entire series, that entire world, that series all came, exploded from a single line in a song by the band Rise Against.
Ooh.
And it's just, my hands are soaking in the blood of angels, which is a fucking epic line. And the entire series just
line for a series
exploded out of my head from that one line, basically. And sometimes that happens, and it's glorious. It's like, it's that moment of pure creation where you just enter into that state of just like your mind's just going, blah, 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 so many things just like popping off here and there, and it's just creating a world as you're thinking about it. I love it.
Awesome, man. All right, well, Sins of the Mother is out now. I'll put a link down below if you want to check that out. I can't wait to read it personally, so I'm very, very keen. Thank you for listening or watching to the podcast, and we will see you next week. Bye,
everybody.